Today is Wednesday, October 20th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden renews push for infrastructure bill.
We had a really good, productive meeting, another productive meeting with the president, with the vice president, with Secretary Yellen.
Plus, U.S. to reopen consulate in Jerusalem.
The Trump administration downgraded the Palestinian diplomatic relations with the Palestinians when it closed the U.S. consulate that was specifically for Palestinians.
Also, Australia detects COVID-19 from wastewater samples. Our top story today is in Europe.
Gentlemen, colleagues, it's a particular honor for me to announce the decision of the Conference of Presidents of today to award the Sakharov Prize in 2021 to Alexei Navalny, Russian anti-corruption activist and an advocate for change.
That was Heidi Hautala, the Vice President of the European Parliament, announcing the awarding of the Sakharov Prize to imprisoned Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny on Wednesday.
Alexei Navalny has showed great courage in his attempts to restore the freedom of choice to the Russian people. For many years, he has fought for human rights and fundamental freedom in his country. This has cost him his freedom and merely his life. On behalf of the European Parliament, I call for his immediate and unconditional release. All harassment, intimidation and attacks against the opposition, civil society and media by the Russian authorities must stop.
Navalny, President Vladimir Putin's top critic, survived a nerve agent poisoning while on a domestic flight in Russia. His recognition with the Human Rights Prize will put a new damper on relations between the 27-nation bloc and Russia. They have been on the decline for years, especially following Moscow's 2014 annexation of Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula and its support for a separatist insurgency in eastern Ukraine. The EU imposed sanctions last year on 6 senior Russian officials for their alleged involvement in a poisoning attack on Navalny. Russia denies any involvement in the poisoning. The Sakharov Prize, set up in 1988 and named after Soviet dissident Andrei Sakharov, is awarded every year to those fighting for human rights or democracy. President Joe Biden held a busy day of meeting with lawmakers on Tuesday, seeking to close what may be the signature effort of his administration, a multi-trillion dollar legislative package that expands social security net programs and infrastructure spending. The Democratic Party's Progressives Caucus has been unwilling to pass the infrastructure bill unless it is coupled with a massive budget bill. This funds Biden's campaign pledges on climate, inequality, and social programs. U.S. Representative Pramila Jayapal said on Tuesday she felt, quote, even more optimistic, unquote, about the prospects of Democrats reaching a deal after she and fellow Progressive House lawmakers met with Biden. Jayapal told reporters after the meeting that she thought Biden was trying to get everyone to agree on the spending bill totaling between $1.9 trillion and $2.2 trillion. Initiatives in this original proposal that may see cuts include $322 billion for affordable housing, money for paid family leave, and some $400 billion earmarked to increase home-based care for the elderly and disabled, according to a person familiar with the matter. The president also met on Tuesday morning with moderate Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who have voiced concern about the size of the bill. U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi has set October 31st as a deadline for the House to pass a $1.2 trillion infrastructure deal the Senate has already approved and has brought bipartisan support.
We had a really good, productive meeting, another productive meeting with the president, with the vice president, with Secretary Yellen. And I think we all feel still even more optimistic about getting to an agreement on a really transformational bill that will fundamentally lift people up with the priorities that the Progressive Caucus had laid out 5 months ago. We feel very good that the majority of those priorities will be in this bill. And I think the president has been working incredibly hard to get everybody to a place where we can move this forward and finish this process so that we can start on whatever is the next important thing that we need to do. So I feel like these conversations have been really important. And the president's work with the senators and then with our caucus in the House have been really, really critical for us to be able to move forward. So we're feeling good. The president has consistently laid out a number that is somewhere between 1.9 and 2.2, and it's not the number that we want. We have consistently tried to make it as high as possible. But at the end of the day, the idea that we can do these programs, a multitude of programs, and actually get them going so that they deliver immediate transformational benefits to people is what we're focused on.
That's U.S. Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said the Biden administration intends to move ahead with its plan to reopen the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem. The consulate traditionally had served as a base for the U.S. government to engage with Palestinians until it was closed in 2019. However, Israel is opposed to the plan, saying the move would undermine Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's new government. Oli Harpern is a reporter based in Jerusalem. She tells VOA's Jason Vunganyi that former U.S. President Donald Trump closed the consulate in favor of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem to support Israel's claim on the city as its capital.
Basically, the Trump administration downgraded the Palestinian connection, diplomatic relations with the Palestinians, when it closed the U.S. consulate that was specifically for Palestinians and moved all kinds of diplomatic relations with the Palestinians to a special unit inside the U.S. embassy in Israel. And this basically meant that the relations between the U.S. and the Palestinians was less important than the relations with Israel. And now the Biden administration, following the promise of U.S. President Joe Biden, is planning opening it back up.
It has been said that Prime Minister Bennett's opposition to the opening of the Palestinian consulate was in ways a matter of principle. It's not related to any political timing. How does he, for one, diverge from his predecessor on this particular issue?
Both the former Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the present Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, are on the same page regarding reopening or the existence of a consulate for the U.S. to have relations with the Palestinians. They're both right-wing. They don't want the city of Jerusalem to be divided and that the Palestinians have East Jerusalem as their capital. So they certainly are not interested, neither of them, in this consulate being reopened.
Let's talk about the composition of the current coalition. How would you characterize the current Israeli government?
Well, at present, Israel has a very fragile coalition. It's made up of right-wingers and left-wingers and an Islamist party. And basically, what they do have in common was that they wanted to get rid of Netanyahu. And that's why they agreed, despite their very deep ideological differences, to come together, put those differences aside just to run the country. So they've agreed that they're not going to deal with any of the contentious issues, which is like negotiating with the Palestinians, for example, because that could break up this coalition. So in terms of support or opposition to this move by the Biden administration, you have both in this government. You have, you know, the Meretz left-wing party, and I'm sure the Islamist party and the Labor party, who are all in favor of opening a consulate where Washington has a direct line of communication with the Palestinians, whereas the right-wingers, which the Prime Minister Bennett is a part of, totally oppose it. They want Jerusalem to be the capital only of Israel.
And how would opening the consulate affect this coalition?
I don't think it will, because it's not their decision. They're not deciding to do it. It's the U.S. decision.
That's reporter Oli Halpern speaking with my colleague, Jackson Vunganyi from Jerusalem. The UN Children's Fund reports 10,000 children in Yemen have been killed or maimed since conflict erupted in March 2015 between the Saudi-backed government and Iran-supported Houthi rebels. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UNICEF calls this a shameful milestone. Since the war began, it says four children caught in the fighting have been killed or maimed every day. While the figure of 10,000 deaths and injuries is a lot, the Children's Agency says the number is much higher. UNICEF spokesman James Elder says only cases verified by the United Nations are listed in this latest tally. He says many more child deaths and injuries go unrecorded. As high as these numbers are, he says many more children die from indirect, preventable causes than from the fighting itself. He says children are at risk of dying or falling seriously ill. from diseases such as cholera and measles, as well as acute malnutrition and hunger.
A child dies in Yemen of something that's preventable every 10 minutes, and that is certainly a number that unfortunately has not changed in the last couple of years. Yemen is the most difficult place in the world to be a child. Incredulously, it's getting worse.
Elder, who has just returned from a mission to Yemen, says children are exposed to many dangers. He says 4 out of every 5 children, or more than 11 million children, need humanitarian assistance. He says 400,000 children suffer from severe acute malnutrition, and millions more lack clean drinking water. He says more than 2 million children are out of school. The UNICEF spokesman says Yemen's economy is collapsing and people are struggling to survive.
But people like this are simply out of options. They're selling their jewelry, they're selling their cooking pots. They're doing this to feed their own children. The bottom line is children in Yemen are starving because adults continue to wage a war in which children are the biggest losers.
UNICEF says it urgently needs more than $235 million to continue its life-saving work in Yemen until mid-2022. Otherwise, it warns, it will be forced to reduce or stop its vital assistance for vulnerable children. What this means is crucial therapeutic feeding for thousands of severely acutely malnourished children will be scaled down or stopped. UNICEF says other life-saving measures also will be affected. If the money dries up, it says survivors of this brutal war may no longer have access to safe drinking water, to COVID-19 vaccination programs, to psychosocial support to help people deal with trauma and other essential relief. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The military government that rules Myanmar is reportedly releasing over 5,600 political prisoners who were detained in the protests against the February coup. Local media and activists say the same detainees were swiftly rearrested. Matthew Lara Tonda, Reuters, reports.
The military government that rules Myanmar is reportedly releasing over 5,600 political prisoners who were detained in the protests that hit the country after the military's coup in February. That's according to its state-run television. Video obtained by Reuters shows a release from one prison, but local activists and media reports say some of those people freed were quickly arrested again, something which couldn't be verified. Prisoners are said to include politicians and journalists. The military government has released prisoners several times since the coup. The UN has welcomed the news, but says the military isn't releasing prisoners out of a change of heart, but because of international pressure. The military government says it's committed to peace and democracy.
That's Matthew Laratonda of Reuters. A minister from Myanmar's military junta said authorities are doing their best to revive an economy hit by unrest and pandemic. But he said, quote, sabotage, unquote, by foreign opponents are also partly to blame. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
Myanmar's military-appointed authorities are doing their best to revive an economy in turmoil since the February coup and stabilize the chat currency, a minister told Reuters in a rare interview on Tuesday. Aung Lang U blamed the crisis partly on foreign backers of the junta's opponents.
What's very fast in the evidence is they try to sabotage the banking sector in the country. So as you know, they try to agitate the people to withdraw money from the banks and also, you know, they push the people to, you know, to turn from the digital the payment to the cash payment system.
The currency lost more than 60% of its value in September after the Southeast Asian nation was roiled by months of protests, strikes, and economic paralysis following the coup. The security situation has combined with the global health crisis to push up inflation, the minister said.
From February this year, after the proclamation of the emergency, the inflation increased from 1.51% to 6.51% in July. So this is the updated, you know, data, according to the updated data. But this is largely because of food and non-food items affected by the COVID-19 situation and the disruption to the supply chain. Because money supply is increasing around 20% year-on-year growth, inflation has been rising. That said, There is clear evidence of a coordinated economic sabotage, as I said earlier, by elements working against the government.
Ong Nang U said foreign reserves stand at 11 trillion chat, or $6.04 billion at the central bank's official rate, the first time Myanmar had disclosed its level of foreign currency since the coup. It compares with a World Bank figure of just $7.67 billion at the end of 2020. The minister did not specify which countries were seen as meddling or give evidence to support the claim.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. The World Food Programme says it urgently needs funds, or it may have to cut food rations to more than 500,000 people in Nigeria's conflict-ravaged northeast. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
The World Food Programme says it may be forced to cut food rations to more than 500,000 people in northeastern Nigeria within a matter of weeks. The UN agency is urgently calling for $55 million in the coming weeks for a region that has been hit by years of conflict and where millions have fled an insurgency by militant group Boko Haram. Without additional resources, the WFP says it will run out of funds for emergency food distribution and nutrition support by the end of the month. And WFP spokesperson Thompson Peary said those cuts would be coming as hunger in the area reaches a five-year high.
This is probably the highest that we're witnessing since the crisis exploded in 2016. Approximately 4.4 million people are facing acute food insecurity in the conflict-affected states of Borno, Adamawa and Yobe.
Peary said food assistance is already prioritised for those who are most vulnerable. The situation in Nigeria is also being exacerbated by the fallout of the global health crisis, limited food supply, and high prices. The number of internally displaced people hit 2 million last month, and the WFP estimates that more than 1 million children are malnourished.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Australia's National Science Agency has developed a surveillance system to analyze wastewater samples to detect COVID-19 on long-haul flights. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Researchers in Australia say wastewater testing is another line of defense against COVID-19. The country closed its borders to most foreign nationals in March 2020 and restricted entry and departure to Australian citizens to curb the spread of the virus. However, restrictions will begin to ease in November. As global travel returns, the government science agency, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, or the CSIRO, believe sewage testing on incoming flights can be an effective way to screen passengers for COVID-19. CSIRO's Land and Water Science Director, Dr. Paul Birch, says the test is not time-consuming.
We can turn samples around in as little as 4 hours. But one of the things that we are working on are much more rapid methods so that we could turn around samples even faster than that. So that the analyses could actually be done while passengers are going through customs and picking up their luggage, etc.
The study analysed wastewater samples from lavatories of 37 Australian government repatriation flights from countries authorities categorised as COVID hotspots, including India, France, Britain, South Africa, Canada and Germany, landing at Darwin International Airport between December 2020 and March this year. The research found that 65% of flights showed a positive signal for the virus that causes COVID-19, despite all passengers, except children under five, testing negative to the virus 48 hours before boarding. Dr. Birch believes the system could be valuable.
The WHO continues to suggest to us that we need to be prepared for variants that perhaps are going to be even more challenging than Delta variant. But we can actually detect variants in the wastewater as well, so that would also provide us a signal of when a specific variant, if it does emerge somewhere in the world, actually is entering Australia.
The Delta variant was first identified in India and is one of several variants of concern, health experts say. The WHO uses terms such as variants of concern or variants of interest to warn against strains that might easily spread. Australia's health experts hope to be able to detect the virus, with the study published in the scientific journal Environmental International. The study is a collaboration between the CSIRO, Australia's national airline Qantas, and the University of Queensland. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Authors of a new report on Africa's climate warn the continent is heating up more and faster than other regions in the world, and they say African nations need immediate financial and technological assistance to adapt to the warming environment. Again, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The African continent constitutes 17% of the global population, but is responsible for less than 4% of greenhouse gas emissions, which are leading to climate change. The report finds changing precipitation patterns, rising temperatures, and extreme weather triggered by climate change are happening globally, but notes these events are occurring with greater frequency and intensity in Africa. Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Petteri Talas, says there were 700 major disasters on the continent last year. He says more than half have been flooding events and one-sixth have been storming and drought events, respectively.
We have seen almost 100 million people who have suffered of food insecurity, and they needed humanitarian assistance and the combined effects of conflicts, climate hazards, and especially this COVID-19, they have been contributing to the increase of 40% of food insecurity.
This multi-agency report entitled State of the Climate in Africa 2020 was coordinated by the World Meteorological Organization with the help of the African Union Commission and various UN agencies. The report finds the warming trend over the last three decades in all African subregions was stronger than in the previous 30 years. During this period, it says Africa has warmed faster than the global average temperature over land and ocean combined. It says higher than normal precipitation and flooding predominated in places such as the Sahel, the Rift Valley, and the Kalahari Basin. At the same time, dry conditions prevailed in the northern coast of the Gulf of Guinea and other locations, while drought in Madagascar triggered a humanitarian crisis. Tala says sea level rise is threatening many coastal cities in Africa like Lagos, Nigeria's economic hub and a major financial center in Africa. He says climate change also is having a devastating impact on the last remaining glaciers in East Africa.
Three African glaciers, Mount Kenya, Rwenzori and Kilimanjaro, and you can see that there has been major loss of the sea ice area and also sea ice mass, and if the current trends continue, we won't see any glaciers in Africa in 2040s.
The African Union Commission reports adaptation costs in sub-Saharan Africa are estimated at $30 billion to $50 billion, equivalent to 2 to 3% of regional gross domestic product each year over the next decade. However, it notes the cost of doing nothing will be much higher. By 2030, it says up to 118 million extremely poor people will be subject to devastating impacts of drought and intense heat. It adds subsequent displacement and migration consequently will lead to a further 3% decrease in GDP by 2050. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a pleasant evening.